Thank you. So indeed, today I'm going to talk about coarse graining of 3D spinflow models, and more precisely, this is numerical coarse graining using some tensor network normalization techniques. So first, I will briefly summarize what Bianca explained yesterday about the continuum limit, and I will explain what we are trying to do and how we are trying to do it using tensor network. Then I will describe how we generalize the tensor renormalization group algorithm to deal with constrained spinflow models in 2 plus 1 gravity. I will present some numerical results, discuss those results, and then explain what we are trying to do now to improve basically the algorithm. So as you know, in order to well define the path integral of spinflow models, we have to introduce a discretization. And doing that, we have several issues. The first one is the breaking of the diffeomorphism invariance. And another issue, which is closely related to the previous one, is the fact that the amplitude of the path integral depends on the triangulation. So in order to solve those issues, we would like to achieve the continuum limit. And achieving the continuum limit means that we have to construct an amplitude of the path integral, which is cylindrical consistent. However, given some embedding maps, it's really complicated to find a cylindrical consistent amplitude for the path integral, and therefore we are trying to design an approximation scheme which will give us cylindrical consistent path integral, but with respect to dynamical embedding maps. And dynamical means that we don't assume a priori embedding maps, but we construct the embedding maps during the cross-graining procedure. But this approximation scheme is based on an iterative cross-graining procedure. And what we are interested in is the fixed point of this cross-graining procedure, because usually fixed points enjoy enhanced symmetries, and therefore we hope to recover the diffeomorphism symmetry, the discrete diffeomorphism symmetry, at the fixed points of the renormalization flow. And this is equivalent to having a discretization independent amplitude for the path integral. So as I said, we are trying to define an iterative cross-graining procedure which is based on tensor network cross-graining schemes. And now I think you know that those tensor networks are really useful, usually in condensed matter theory, but people use those techniques in quantum gravity, for instance, and many other fields. And there are a lot of algorithms in 2D for tensor networks, usually for very simple models, so the easing models in 2D, for instance. And the challenge is to generalize those algorithms to 3D, but also to lattice gauge theory and then spinflow models. So the first step was to go to 3D, and this is what Bianca, Sebastian Steinhaus, and Sebastian Misera did last summer by defining those decorated tensor networks. And with those decorated tensor networks, we can deal with abelian lattice gauge theories in 3D. So that was the first step. The next step is to deal with the non-abelian groups. And obviously, the main difference between the two is the form of the gauge invariance, which is a lot more complicated in the case of non-abelian groups. So this is this project. And once we have an algorithm for non-abelian lattice gauge theory, we can then go to spinflow models in 3D. So for now, we do not look at 3 plus 1 gravity. We only focus on 2 plus 1 gravity. And we do another simplification, is that we don't work with Lie groups, which would be impossible. We have to work with finite groups. And because this is the very first algorithm with non-abelian groups, we focus on the simplest one, which is the symmetric group. The symmetric group has only 6 group elements and 3 representations. And this is the simplest, the one that we can consider. The next step would be to go to quantum groups, because these groups are larger and there is this nice interpretation with the cosmological constant, and therefore that would be interesting. Then we work only with a cubical regular lattice, because this is the simplest space filling that you can use in three dimension. But it's not the only reason. There is another reason, which is physical, is that using a cubical regular lattice, you get four valent intertwiners. I will explain more precisely, but because you get four valent intertwiners in your spinform models, you can implement simplicity constraints. So despite the fact that we are in 3D, we have some freedom, and therefore we can use this freedom to implement constraints, which allows to go from topological BF model to actual spinform models in 3D gravity. Then the idea of this project is to implement those constraints and to study the fate of those simplicity. Yes.
What's the interpretation of the
simplicity constraints in? There is no real physical meaning. It's just we want to study how those constraints evolve during the cross-screening procedure, and we hope that that will give us information for 4D, for instance. So kind of a toy model. So indeed, we want to study the fate of the constraints during the cross-screening procedure, and this is interesting for several reasons, but the main point is that if we get new fixed points, the fixed points that we don't really expect, for instance, that will lead to new continuum representation of the theory. And I will explain just after. So the reason why we hope that we will find extra fixed points is that we have some previous results with SpinNet models. So SpinNets, this is what Sebastian explained this morning. Those are 2D analogs of spinform models, and they share a lot of features, and therefore, we think that the results with SpinNets give useful information for spinform models. Here, for instance, you have a phase diagram for SpinNets with the quantum groups. And as you can see, you have a very rich phase structure because we have several fixed points. So what I mean by fixed point is if you take a point on this phase diagram, because this is a 3D phase diagram, there are three parameters associated to that point. It means that if you parameterize the initial tensor or the initial system with those three parameters, you will flow towards a fixed point, and this is the fixed point associated to the given color. So all the points here which share the same color, it means that they all flow towards the same fixed point. And this is what we mean by phase. We define a phase as the set of points which flow towards exactly the same fixed point. And when we get a new fixed point with that kind of theories, it means that we define a new topological field theories. So as I said, during the cross-graining procedure, this iterative randomization, we define at each step the dynamical embedding maps. So the embedding maps change at each iteration of the cross-graining procedure. And when you get a fixed point, you get a corresponding set of embedding maps, which means that the notion of refinement limit that you get is with respect to those dynamical embedding maps. And if you have new dynamical embedding maps, it means that you have a new notion of refinement limit. And your new notion of refinement limit means you can define a new vacuum which is associated to a new representation of LQG. So if you have a phase diagram with a lot of extra fixed points, basically you can define a theory with respect to many different notions of excitations. And for instance, we have two examples. We have the Hashtag-Lewandowski representation and the new BF representation, which are two examples of the same theory, but defined with respect to different notions of excitations. So this is the general idea. Now the framework we are considering is the following. First of all, we start from the partition function of a lattice gauge theory. So you start with, you discretize the space-time, your 3D space-time using a cubical regular lattice. Then you consider the dual of this cubical lattice. So the dual, the two complex corresponding to a cubical lattice looks like that. And you discretize the theory on this two complex, which means that you put variables on the edges. And then you consider the product of the variables around a face to define face variables. And you then define weights on those phase variables. So this is just the formulation of a lattice gauge theory. We then do the trick that Benjamin presented on Monday, that you can, after a Fourier transformation, you can define a Hall projector that you put on each edge of the two-complex. And this Hall projector projects onto an invariant subspace. So this is just another way to formulate the lattice gate theory. And then we do another trick, which is that we introduce an orthonormal basis for the Hall projector, so an orthonormal basis of intertwiners. So we rewrite the Hall projector, and graphically it looks like that, because on each edge you have a Hall projector, you can introduce this decomposition on each edge, and then you can take half of this decomposition to factorize everything around a vertex. And by doing that, you can change the form of this partition function by defining a vertex amplitude. And this vertex amplitude is the object that we are interested in. So this is basically the tensor that we consider and that we put into the tensor network. So as I said, we have a little bit of freedom, and thanks to this freedom, we can implement simplicity constraints. So the Hall projector are on the edges, and the Hall projector projects onto the invariant subspace of the product of the representation spaces associated to the faces meeting at one edge. So here you have one edge, four faces meet at this edge, and therefore you have four representations, four representation spaces, which means that the invariant subspace is not trivial. If we had only three representation meeting at one edge, so that would be the case with a triangulation, we would get a trivial invariant subspace that would be just one intertwiner, basically the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients of the three representations. So here we have some freedom, and we can therefore define another projector which projects onto a smaller subspace. And by defining this new projector, we can actually implement simplicity constraints. So this is exactly what we do. We define a new projector, and that way we can parameterize the system with simplicity constraints. So this is the parameterization of the system. Now the algorithm. So this is exactly what Sebastian explained this morning. This is the TRG algorithm, or this is the same as the Gouin algorithm. It depends on the name. And so this is just an iteration of two steps. The first one is a splitting using a singular value decomposition, and the other one is a construction of tensors, basically. So very quickly, here you have a square lattice. You split all the tensors using the SVD. So here the triangles correspond to the unitary matrices that you get by doing this factorization. So for instance, this triangle would be this part, and the second triangle would be this part. You do it for each tensor according to two different schemes, so along this diagonal or this diagonal, so that you can contract four isometries to define a new tensor. So here, for instance, you can see that you have a square. Basically, you contract those tensors. So this is the orange dot. And what you get after that is a new lattice, which is bigger in some sense, and there is a rotation. So here, this algorithm is the simplest algorithm that you can do with tensor network. So we don't put what Giffre explained yesterday. We don't put any disentanglers, which means that we don't explicitly remove the short-range correlations. That would be way too complicated within that framework. So we just focus on this algorithm. So this is in 2D. Now we are interested in 3D. So this is how it looks like. What we do is that basically we apply the TRG algorithm in each plane of the cubical lattice. So here you have one plane, and in that plane we will do the TRG algorithm. So before I explain that, just want to explain that as I said, we have a vertex amplitude, which is the tensor that we consider. But because it's a little bit complicated to work with the vertex amplitude, we take a dual point of view, and actually we associate the amplitude to a cube, which is a lot easier. So this is just a slight change of variables, but there is no, yeah, this is just a change of point of view. So here, that means that inside each cube, you have a tensor. So you can picture some, this is exactly a tensor network, but with cubes. And the main difference here with spinforms is that when you do the splitting of tensor using the SVD, there is a geometrical interpretation behind that. It's not just a factorization of matrix, but because spinforms are defined with respect to a triangulation, we have to define what happens with respect to this triangulation. And in that case, the discretization is not triangulation. Here we have cubes. So a splitting of the tensor means a splitting of the cube geometrically. And this splitting follows exactly the same scheme as previously. So we split the cubes according to two different diagonal planes so that we can glue four prisms together, which means four unitary matrices, in order to define a new cube which is bigger, basically. So this is exactly the same, but with cubes and in 3D. So those drawings correspond to the cross-graining in one plane. And because we want to cross-grain in space, then you have to rotate, or basically do exactly the same in an orthogonal plane. And if you keep doing that in all the orthogonal planes, at the end, you will cross-grain space and not just a 2D plane. So that's the idea, and in practice, what we do is slightly different. We don't want to consider tensors, like, I don't know, if you have a cubical lattice with 100 cubes, you don't want to keep track of 100 tensors. So what we do is that we use the translational invariance of the lattice to focus on one cube only. So what we do is that we take one cube, we make a copy of this cube, and then we split the two copies according to two orthogonal planes. So this is exactly what we do here. Let's say that we focus on this cube. We will cut this cube according to this plane, and we cut the copy of the cube according to this plane, which means that you get four different prisms. And with those four different prisms, you can glue them in order to get this orange shape, which is just a bigger cube. So this is exactly what those drawings mean. We get four prisms from one cube, and then we glue back the four prisms in order to get a bigger cube. So this is the result. And then, in order to cross-grain in an orthogonal plane, we need to make a rotation of the cube. So between this drawing and this drawing, this is just a rotation of the cube. So everything I've explained, so basically with that, you can cross-grain abelian lattice guess theory. This is how the abelian algorithm works. Now here we're interested in non-abelian theories, and therefore we have to put a little bit more structure. What we have to do is define a new graph, which is a spin network on the boundary of the cube. So you define a spin network which is dual to the surface of the cube. So here, so this is the dashed lines are the spin networks, and the vertices are dual to faces, and the links of the spin network are dual to edges of the cube. We put this spin network, and then we do another change of variable in the sense that instead of having the variables on the edges of the cube, we put the variables on the links of the boundary graph. The intertwiners of the spinform model, they were on the faces of the cube. So now we put them on the vertices of the boundary graph. And this is why this is a spin network, because basically you have group variables or representation on the links, and you have intertwiners at the vertices. So this is a spin network. And at this stage, we have two possibilities. We could work with this full gauge invariant spin network, but we would have different issues. The first one is that you would have a lot of variables. So the variables here are the group variables that you put on the links. And with this spin network, you have 18 edges, 18 links, which means that we would have to keep track of 18 variables, which means a tensor with 18 indices, which is huge. So that's an issue. And there is another issue, which is related to the conservation of the Gauss constraint when you do an embedding. So here I have just like a toy model to explain to you this issue. Here, okay, let's say this is a piece of the spin network. And so the gauge invariance is satisfied on this spin network. And let's say that we want to coarse grain this graph by removing the small triangle here inside. And if we do that by applying an embedding map, for instance, that would be the result. But with that result, the gauge invariant is not satisfied anymore. So here it's satisfied. Here, if you look at the result, you don't have the gauge invariant anymore, which is bad because we want to preserve this constraint during the cross-graining procedure. So because we don't want to deal with this issue, what we do is that we gauge fix the spin network. So the gauge fixing, we do the usual procedure, which is to define a spanning tree on the spin network, and then we gauge fix this spanning tree. So before I draw the spanning tree, we do another change of point of view to simplify the visualization of the cross-graining, which is an unfolding of the cube. So what you have here is it's called a net. It's a net of the cube. So you can visualize that if you fold all the faces, you get a 3D cube. And then, I do a slight modification. So those two faces would be the top and the bottom faces of the cube. And during the cross-graining procedure, we split the cube in halves, which means that we cut along a diagonal plane, and therefore you cut two faces. So that's why those two faces, there is an edge, there is a diagonal edge, because we split along this diagonal edge. So here I just like split the triangle. So this is just another way to visualize the cube, which makes it a little bit more symmetric. So physically nothing happens for now. I then put the dual spin network. So the spin network is dual to the surface. So this is dual to this net. And then I define a spanning tree. So a spanning tree is a subgraph which connects all the vertices of the graph without forming any loop. So here the tree is made of the solid lines, and the dashed lines, which do not belong to the tree, are called leaves, and the variables that we keep are on these leaves. Because what we do is that we get fix the tree by fixing all the group variables to the identity, for instance. So basically, we remove all the variables on the tree, and we keep only the ones on the leaves. And you can, using this formula, which is E is the number of edges and V the number of vertices, you can get the number of leaves that you get. And with this spin network, you have 9 leaves, which means that the tensor that we consider, the tensor that we put in the tensor network, has only 9 indices, instead of 18 if you don't do the gauge fixing. So that's one nice feature of this gauge fixing. The other one is that we don't have to deal with the gauge invariance anymore because this is gauge fix. So this is gauge fix, but there is always what we call a residual gauge invariance, which is like a global gauge invariance, which means that we have to average after each iteration with respect to the adjoint action to make sure that this residual gauge invariance is satisfied. But this is easy to do. It's not an issue for the actual cross-graining procedure. So now I can explain in details how we actually split and glue the cubes together. It looks like that. So here I just focus on two leaves to make things a little bit more simpler. So the idea is that if you glue two shapes, when you glue the so the geometrical shapes, you have to merge the edges together, which means that you have two shapes with the two boundary spin networks, and you want to merge the shapes, which means that at the end you will have only one spin network. So somehow you have to merge those two spin networks, which is a gluing. And this is complicated only for the leaves, because when you have the, for instance, when you have to glue three edges together, it's really easy because they are get fixed, there is nothing to do. But when we have to merge leaves together, it's a bit more complicated. So here, let's say that this leaf corresponds to one shape. So here you could have a prism or a cube, and this leaf is associated to another shape, and you want to merge the two shapes. So you have to merge those two leaves. And there is the way we do it is that we split the edges, and we say that half of the edge is made of a tree edge. So basically, we extend the tree over half the edge, which is fine because the tree is get fixed, so we can do that. It's not an issue. And then we just define the gluing as an integration over those tree edges. So here, the solid lines, they belong to the tree. And by integrating with respect to those tree edges, we do the gluing. So, okay, so this is this formal formula. But then if we want to look explicitly what happens, we have to go to the spin representation, which means that we have to do a Fourier transformation. So this is what happens here. So it looks complicated, but actually it's not. It's just a Fourier transformation. And then we play a little bit with the representation matrices to get this result. And this result is actually the Fourier transformation of one edge, which is this edge. And here we have a coefficient, which is the Fourier transform of the edge, which depends on the Fourier transform on this one and the Fourier transform of this one. And if we look at the formula, we can understand exactly what happens when we glue the sleeves together. First of all, we see that we need to identify the representation. So rho here is the representation on the edge. And we see that when we want to glue leaves together, we have first to identify the representations. Then, if we look at the magnetic indices, we can see that there is a contraction pattern for the magnetic indices. And basically, depending on all the conventions that we have to keep track during the cross-graining, for instance, the orientation of the edges, we get a different contraction pattern for the magnetic indices. So in practice, what we have to do is that we have to do once this calculation, and then we use directly the result to actually glue leaves together. So we know this result, and then we know that in order to glue two leaves, we just have to contract the magnetic indices and identify the representation. And this is why the tensor network formalism is very interesting, because if you have tensor, you just have to contract indices of the tensor together, the indices being the magnetic indices in that case. You just have to contract the indices, and this is the gluing of two leaves, and therefore the gluing of two cubes or two prisms, depending on what you consider. So, yes?
Question, so before you have two different representations, row left and row right, and then like you have several new rows, right? Because you have some.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, which means because you don't fix the representation, because you always have to take into account all the representations.
But this new row will then be the new label for your new effective.
Yeah, exactly. So the label for this edge would be a row, and the magnetic indices would be NL and R, because we sum over M prime here.
And then this M is then the new magnetic index
Which, the M prime? Which one? Yes, I mean, actually the magnetic indices come from those ones. Uh-huh. But in order to know which one you keep and how you distribute the magnetic indices, you have to do this calculation. So for instance here, you see that, the left magnetic index is actually the right magnetic index of this leaf, and this one is the right magnetic index of this leaf.
Okay.
And depending on the convention, the distribution will be different. So the gluing is actually the simple part because it's very well defined, it's just a calculation. Then we have to do the splitting. So the splitting, as I said, is performed with a singular value decomposition. So here, let's say that this is your tensor. In that case, this is a matrix, but let's say that you put your tensor here and you do a singular value decomposition to split this tensor. So mathematically, this is how the splitting goes. But then we have to look at the geometrical interpretation because here the tensor is not just a tensor with numbers. It is associated to a shape, and more precisely, it is associated to the boundary spin network. So when we do this splitting, we have to look at precisely what happens to the spin network, the boundary spin network. So the splitting, when we split the cube along the diagonal plane, it means that you cut here along this plane, so right in the middle of the shape, which means that you cut four edges of the spin network. So one, two, three, and there is another one which goes around, so from here to here. So you cut four edges, and well, you have to look at precisely how this cutting happens. And actually, this splitting, is exactly the inverse of the gluing. So you start from one edge. So that, for instance, that could be this one, this edge in the middle, so which belongs to the original shape. And then when you split, you get two leaves. One will belong to the new left shape, and the other one will belong to the new right shape. So this is exactly the inverse of the gluing. Now the tricky part is that here you have one leaf with one representation and two magnetic indices. Because this is the inverse of the gluing, we know that the representation matrix on this edge and this one will be exactly the same as this one. We identify the representation matrices. But then there is the question of the magnetic indices, because here you have two magnetic indices, but here you have two leaves, and therefore you have four magnetic indices. So somehow you need to introduce two extra magnetic indices. And actually those magnetic indices are provided by the singular value decomposition. So the K that we sum over here is like a superindex that contains all the magnetic indices that we need. More precisely, we have to, so Sebastian explained this morning that when you do the SVD, you actually truncate the SVD in the sense that you don't keep all the singular values, otherwise you would have to keep increasing the number of variables, so you have to put a truncation. And the way we truncate here, we truncate so that we get exactly the number of magnetic indices that we need. So basically we cut four edges. Actually, one of them belongs to the tree, so we don't have to do anything. And then we have to cut only three leaves. Three leaves means that we need six extra magnetic indices. And those six extra magnetic indices are provided by the superindex K. And the tricky part here is that you have somehow to distribute this superindex into those smaller indices. So you have to make a choice to distribute those values. So you get from the SVD like a set of magnetic indices, and then you have to decide, okay, I assign the first one to this edge, the next one to this edge, and so that's the part of the splitting that we don't fully control, because we have to make a choice, and therefore we may reduce the possibilities. Okay, so this is... Okay. Yep.
So these extra magnetic indices you get from the SVD.
Yeah.
And I think you told me that one of the problems that the SVD can turn around in this space of all these indices, and it's not really clear what they can... Those magnetic indices that you want.
Yeah, basically the SVD is a matrix factorization. So So you just have numbers, and then the SVD provides the factorization. But then this factorization doesn't know the physical meaning of the magnetic indices. I mean, so basically we have like a mathematical definition of the splitting. Then we have a geometrical definition of the splitting, and somehow the two definitions must match. And this is the non-trivial part. And that's why basically we have to make a choice so that we make sure that this matches.
So like the magnetic indices that are missing because you're going from basically now to coarser to finer, mm-hmm. you need to get them from the other variables. And this is like, and this is given by the SVD, but there's no good way how to guess this.
There is no way to guess because the way the matrix is organized after the SVD, it's not related to like the input because the singular values are ordered with respect to the weight of the singular values from the biggest one to the smallest one. So this order influences the order of the matrices U and V. But so this is the only influences there is. It's not related to our geometrical interpretation. Yeah, basically we have consistency checks where we know some fixed points and we make this choice so that the fixed points that we expect are actually fixed points. Yes, you can guess. Yeah. Okay. So that's the mathematical interpretation of the splitting. Now there is a physical interpretation, which is that this splitting, this SVD, what we do, actually provides the dynamical embedding maps. So this is why we get dynamical embedding maps, and they change at each step of the cross-grading procedure, because at each step you get a different tensor, so which means a different amplitude of the path integral, and you use this amplitude, well, you split this amplitude, and the splitting provides embedding maps. So at each step you have new embedding maps, and this is the reason why those are dynamical embedding maps. And the cylindrical consistency that you get at the fixed point is with respect to those dynamical embedding maps. So we now have all the tools to actually look at the algorithm. So very quickly, basically here, that would be one initial tensor that you want to glue into two prisms. And this is how the splitting goes. So you have to split the spin network so that you get one spin network on one side, one spin network on the other side. And if you look at the dual shape of this spin network, it's actually a prism. So this is the splitting, and then so you have to do two splittings, and then you have to glue everything together. That looks a little bit complicated, but this, we just have to keep track of all the conventions, and then that's fine. So this would be the final result, so the new cube that we need to rotate in order to do the cross-graining in an orthogonal plane. And the rotation within that framework means that we have to basically rearrange the 2D net, so the net of the cube which is behind, which means that you rearrange the spin network. And at the very end, you need to do a tree transformation to go back to the very first shape or drawing. So basically this drawing is exactly the same as this one. It's not exactly the same because we do two splittings. So, this corresponds to one splitting, and the very first one I showed is another splitting. So basically you need to do a tree transformation to go back to the very first stage of the cross-graining so that you can actually keep cross-graining. So this is the condition to have an iterative cross graining, obviously. At some point, you need to go back to the beginning. OK, so that is the how the cross graining goes. And now I can show you some results. So the results I'm going to show are for the symmetric group, S3, so which is the simplest one. And with this symmetric group, we can parameterize spinform models. So to parameterize spinform models, first of all, we have to compute the spin network, compute explicitly the spin network amplitude of the initial tensor. So this is your initial tensor, and you have to evaluate the spin network. So because we are gauge fixed, it means that you have representation matrices on each leaf of the graph. So you have 9 representation matrices. You would have dimensional factors on all the edges. And then you have intertwiners on each vertex of this spin network. So at the end, you get a very long formula. And you have to contract all the magnetic indices to get the corresponding spin network amplitude. So that's the first step. And from this spin network amplitude, you can deduce the amplitude for BF. So the amplitude for BF is defined as the amplitude of the spin network where all the group elements are fixed to 1. And so what you have here is the BF amplitude in the spin representation because it depends on the representations on the edges. Then if you want, you can go to the group representation by using the spin network in order to do the Fourier transformation, basically. So you use this spin network to go from the spin representation of the spin form amplitude to the group representation of the spin form amplitude. So what you get here is actually a tensor with 9 indices, and this is the starting point of the cross-graining procedure. So that's the tensor in the case of BF, but what we want to do is implement constraints. And then you have, as we said many times, you have a lot of possibilities to put the constraints. The phase space is huge. And one choice you can make is, for instance, to put parameters directly on the dimensional factors of the representations. So we are dealing with S3. S3 are 3 representations. You have the trivial representation, which is 1-dimensional, the sine representation, which is also 1-dimensional, and there is another representation, the standard representation, which is 2-dimensional. So for BF, you would have to take those dimensional factors, basically, which are the effective dimensional factors. And then if you want to put some parameters in order to extend the phase space, you can put the parameters directly on the dimensional factors. So here in that case, we would have 2 parameters, which would be alpha and beta. And if you change those parameters, you get a different initial tensor, and then you can look at where this initial tensor flows. And you get, for this parameterization, that kind of result. So here you have a 2D phase diagram because we have only 2 parameters. Alpha, which is the coefficient on the sine representation, and beta, the coefficient on the standard representation. And what we get in that case, we get 3 phases. So the blue one is BF. This is just BF, which means that if you take 1 point in this phase, so this point is associated to 2 numbers, alpha and beta, if you parameterize the system with those parameters, you flow towards BF. And BF is located here on the phase diagram, actually. So all those points, they flow towards BF. Here, the green phase is the high temperature phase, or the strong coupling phase, or the disordered phase, the different names. So again, all the points, all the models characterized by those parameters, they all flow towards the high temperature phase. And here you have another one, which is a little bit in between, which is a disordered phase, but with respect to the normal subgroup of S3. So the normal subgroup is S3. And so yeah, this is a phase which is disordered with respect to that group. So in that case, we have three phases. And if we look at previous results with spin nets, which are supposed to be analogs to spin four models, we get a similar phase diagram with three phases. And actually, if you look at the shape of the phases, it's consistent with this result. So when you get a phase diagram like that, then the next step would be to look at the phase transition in order to find some non-trivial fixed points, for instance, which would correspond to non-trivial implementation of the simplicity constraints. But this is what I did. I looked at this phase transition line, for instance, in order to find a new fixed point. But unfortunately, I didn't find any, which can be explained by different, there can be different explanations. The very first one is that we consider S3, which is extremely simple because we have only three representations, two of them are one dimensional. So it's a very poor group. We cannot do a lot with that group. And therefore, the fact to have three phases maybe is good enough in the sense that maybe we shouldn't find anything exotic or anything new, even if we put constraints. Then there could be another explanation, which is that, as I said, during the splitting, we have to do this distribution of indices. So we have to make a choice. And by making this choice, we could reduce our possibilities. And somehow we could force the system to flow towards some fixed points and not some other fixed points. So that could be an explanation. And then the final explanation could be the fact that we don't take care of the short-range correlations. So Giffrey would say that this is the main explanation, because if you don't take care of those short-range correlations, especially close to the phase transition, you don't fully control what you do. The cross-graining is not accurate enough near the phase transition, so you cannot get something non-trivial. So what we would like to do is first to address the two first issues. The first one, obviously, is that we need to consider a bigger group. But in order to consider a bigger group, we have to simplify a little bit this cross-graining procedure. Because even if the initial tensor network algorithm is quite simple, when you go to spin foam, it's actually very complicated. In terms of memory, you get huge tensors. I mean, this morning, Sebastian gave you a taste of the size of the tensor that you can get. In that case, it's huge too. So that's an issue. And if you want to go to larger groups, you need somehow to reduce the size of the tensor. And in order to address the second issue, we would like to do a geometrical embedding to control a little bit more this very important step of the procedure. The idea to do this geometrical embedding is to first analytically define coarser and finer variables. So what I mean is that the coarser variables would be the variables that we want to keep after the cross-graining step. And the finer variables are the variables that should be less important, and therefore we can remove them. And that shouldn't, in terms of accuracy, that should be good, because we would remove only variables that are not very important. So we have to analytically define those coarser and finer variables, and then embed only the finer ones. So here, just to give you a taste of this geometrical embedding, I consider a simpler situation, which is an abelian lattice gauge theory. So in that case, we don't need the spin network. We can directly work with a cube. And the representations are one-dimensional, which means that the Gauss constraint is very simple. For a face, if you sum the representations around a face, the sum should be zero. This is the Gauss constraint. And what we would like to do is, so first we glue two cubes together. So we have to identify the edges that we glue together, and we get something like that. And with this new shape, we want to define finer and coarser variables. And here in this simple example, we could choose the cursor variable to be the sum of those two representations, which geometrically makes sense because from two edges, we would like to form only one. So a natural choice is just to sum the corresponding representations. So we would do that on those two edges, then we would do the same on those two edges, which is why we get, again, the sum of the representations. So those new variables would be the cursor variables, and the one on those edges correspond to the finer variables. Because geometrically, what we want to do is actually remove those edges, so it makes sense to define finer variables on those edges. And if you look at the Gauss constraint on the new shape, this is consistent with those two Gauss constraints. So basically, if you sum the Gauss constraint on this face with the Gauss constraint on this one, you get the Gauss constraint on this one. So this is consistent in terms of the gauge invariance. So it's probably too simple to actually give something interesting, this very simple case. But that gives you an idea of how we could actually analytically define cursor and finer variables. And then we don't have to really look at the embedding of the finer ones because those are less important variables. So even if the embedding is not properly done, it doesn't really matter because they are not very important variables. And that could be a solution to the distribution of the magnetic indices that are, I mean, with this algorithm, there was no distribution of indices, so that would solve one of the issues. So to summarize, here we have the first tensor network algorithm for 3D non-abelian lattice gauge theories, and actually we have more than that because we can actually deal with spinform models and with simplicity constraints. Obviously, we can do a lot to improve this algorithm, and we have to do a lot. First of all, we could define a symmetry projecting algorithm. So this is what Sebastian explained a little bit this morning, taking into account symmetries to get a more efficient algorithm. And we obviously have to define properly what this geometrical embedding is. Then the natural next step is to consider larger groups, because if we want to look at like physical spinform models, we need larger groups. The symmetry group is too simple to get something physical and very interesting. And one choice is quantum groups because, well, this is natural cutoff for SU2, for instance, and there is this nice interpretation with the cosmological constant. So actually, an efficient algorithm with SU2k could give some nice information about the cosmological constant. And then, obviously, there is the last step, which is to go to 4D. We could actually generalize what we did here in 4D with the hypercubical lattice. But the main issue is the computational cost of the cross-grinning. That would be impossible, even if with a very efficient code, even if you use all the nodes of Titan, the HPC that we have at PI, that wouldn't be possible. So somehow we have to come up with a new algorithm at some point with four simplices, and we need to do that because there is a huge difference between hypercube and four simplices. So just to give you an idea, if I do exactly the same procedure as here, so putting a boundary spring network and gauge fixing some variables, with a hypercube you would get 17 variables, which is huge. But with four simplices, you would have only six variables, which is even less than what we have in 3D. But the main issue to come up with an algorithm with four simplices is that there is no regular space filling of the four-dimensional space. Even in 3D, you cannot do a space filling with tetrahedral, and you have exactly the same with in 4D. I mean, a regular uniform space filling, which is quite necessary when you want to use tensor network normalization techniques. So that's the main goal, but we still have to improve a little bit our algorithms. Thank you.
That's it. Regarding using four simplices. Sorry. you could create a kind of a semi-regular structure. You take these four simplices and split them, the Kalba cubes and split them into four simplices. And thus you find structures, also your cost structure and so on. I mean, it's a lot more work in the end because you have to handle many more cases. But you could flow from something to the same state.
I think if you want to split a Halberg cube in four simplices, you have basically you need 24 simplices to put them together to get Halberg cube, which is a lot. So you would have to keep track to 24 different tensors, and at some point put everything together.
Yes.
At the end. So in principle,
but
yes,
symmetries.
Maybe. Maybe, but okay, that would be a possibility, but I'm not sure it's actually in practice, and I don't know if it's possible. But
I think 24 tensors is the 6 vectors is much less memory than 70 vectors.
Maybe.
Because we just add them.
Yeah, it's probably more efficient, but then, I mean, in 3D, you can do the same, like you can split a half a cube. Into like prisms, and then cut the prisms into tetrahedra, for instance. And so they did some simulations with this splitting on 3D, and for some reasons it's a little bit less accurate. So you would probably lose a little bit of accuracy by doing such a procedure. That could be a possibility.
Yeah, so it looked like that the two variables that you were looking at were alpha and beta. Those were the phase weights, right?
Phase weights? Well, not really. No. I mean, those are just parameters that you put in order to like reduce the size of the environment subspace. I mean, you know, projects into a smaller environment subspace. Yeah, the choice is a little bit funny of parameters. You could, I mean, maybe something more natural would be to put directly parameters on the intertwiners.
Uh-huh. So, but were these parametrizing different simplicity constraints, so to speak?
Well, depending on the choice of the parameters, basically you implement differently the simplicity constraints. So this is exactly, you know, when you define the orthonormal basis for the half projector, then you can like put coefficients and basically remove some of the basis elements.
Oh, okay.
So this is kind of what happens.
So in the end, you just described this new idea of how to coarse-grain by gluing cubes together and then identifying. So this the idea that you get on the coarse cube, you get again a new spin network, right?
That's
what you would like to have in the non-Newtonian case. Is this sort of more straightforward to get there the right, like when the indices again, in comparison to your splitting? Or like is there more that's economical way to get this new spin network?
Than gluing and then embedding variables, you mean?
Well then splitting and gluing and
well, this is what basically we want to avoid the splitting.
Yes.
Because of this distribution of magnetic indices issue. So that's why we would like to just glue and then embed.
Mm-hmm.
So that we don't have to basically look at the result exactly of the embedding. So
avoid scale.
Yeah, that would be more analytical, and then the numerical part that we don't fully control would be almost trivial. I mean, that would be the idea.
Hmm.
So the problem is to have a clear idea
or stringing of spin networks. Yeah. And that's much more non-trivial than one would think.
Yeah.
Because of the Gaussian
stabilization.
I mean, in terms of networks, to accurately describe the critical point, mm-hmm. you put this entanglement in. So when you drew that phase diagram,
mm-hmm.
how do you know your phase transition points are reliable?
Oh, you mean like comparing to other results, for instance?
Sure, but without disentanglers, they can't really describe these critical points.
But basically, without disentanglers, we would say that qualitatively what we get, like the form of the phase, the number of phases, for instance, would be consistent. But then, if you want an accurate value of the position of the phase transition line, in that case, you would have to remove somehow the correlations, probably. yeah, we expect that qualitatively what we get is good, but then quantitatively you would need to do something more accurate. But maybe, I mean, okay, Giffre would say that if you don't remove at all the correlations, you cannot get anything interesting or non-trivial around the face transition. So maybe, even with S3, maybe...
you can get an idea of what it is, but to actually describe it...
Yeah, yes, yes. But we don't know anything about spin forms, basically. We don't have any information. So if we could get even a rough idea of a good model or even a new model for spin form, that would be good enough because we don't have any information. So yeah. If we can get...
So this is kind of... I mean, the question is also computational complexity.
Yeah.
This algorithm of Geoffrey, you know, that was paper was done in January this year, and the precise paper was done like 10 days ago, and it's a 2D. So the difference just of this PNR, the simple PNR algorithm in 2D, is the thing which we have done here, 3D, and complexity is kind of a factor of, I don't know,
They don't even know how to do it in 3D yet.
It's a factor of 1,000 just to do it without anything. And this is the first algorithm which really works for landscapes.
So that picture drew was a qualitative picture. I got the impression it was a quantitative one.
That
was qualitative.
Yeah, mostly, yes.
But the point is really to just ignore whether there could be a new face.
Have you looked at the face space for alpha bigger than 1? Because it's very naive.
I don't think so, but you would probably flow to BF. Because, I mean, if you look at the face diagram, basically everything, I mean, I guess the face for BF would just keep going in that direction. I don't know.
Alpha equals 1 as well?
Alpha equals 0 here?
Equals 0.
Less than that direction.
Yeah.
I don't think I checked, but I could. But I would expect that you would flow towards the same here. But I could check in. But
it's just as I said. I mean, this very naive RG flow. One can see a fixed point there, which is at alpha equals 1.4 or something. But it's not clear whether that's an artifact. I think that is, I mean, from what I understood, it's the same alpha.
Oh.
I mean, the fixed points are the same ones. So I guess it's the same.
I could try it.
My question is very naive. You were trying to discover, I didn't understand most of this. But you said that in some moment you had a problem of choice of this and that, and maybe this thing was wrong or right. And you said that you took the choice to preserve some fixed points that you knew you had to have.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, but you didn't say which ones. Those three. That was my question. You didn't discover any new things. So discovered three faces because you put in by hand.
Basically we made a choice for BF, and then we got the other ones.
So
we don't force all the phases. I mean, we...
mathematically, the algorithm, you know, the complete tensor network algorithm, we would not even care about this question. So in this sense, it is correct. The only thing would happen is that this choice we do could completely screw up the meaning, the interpretation of our spin indices, which we believe are even spin indices. But it's kind of unlikely to happen here because we believe that the flow is still the faces all differ by the number of eigenvalues pair spins have lost, or just in the number of eigenvalues you have in the end. So this holds anyway. So basically, it doesn't really matter what you make, what kind of choice you make, it would still be correct algorithm. And then you would just, if there would be another phase, we would have seen this phase. Mm-hmm. we would maybe have put in the not the correct interpretation of the space.
And the choice we make is just at the one step. I mean, if the algorithm wasn't consistent, there would be an issue. For instance, when we glue or when we do a trivial summation at some point, there is just this tiny step where we make a choice, and this is consistent with the rest. So it's not a we don't force everything. We just at some point.
Yep. Let's go for coffee. And yeah, back at
4 o'clock.
Okay, in 20 minutes.
Well, 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you.